Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this event, White Ignorance and the Struggle Against Gentrification in Halifax, Past and Present. My name is Max Haven. I'm one of the co-directors, along with Alex Kasnabich, who's trying to get the fans to work. He's gotten the fans to work. Excellent. Of the Radical Imagination Project, which is the host of tonight's event. I'd like to begin this event, as we begin all events we can, by acknowledging that we are on unsurrendered, unceded Mi'kmaq territory, and we would like to thank the Mi'kmaq people for allowing us to remain here and enjoy the fruits of this land and build a life upon it. And it's to the question of how we build a life upon this land that we are turning tonight. We are talking about difficult issues. We're talking about the histories of race and racism and the histories of gentrification, the questions of urban development, the questions of property, and the questions of dispossession of property in this city. Originally, when I talked to Ted about this event, when I was in Montreal visiting, we had thought it might be a small event for a few people who might be interested in the topic. And very quickly, once we advertised the event, we realized that it was going to be much, much more popular than that, which is a wonderful thing. It shows that there's a great deal of interest within our various communities in this city on this issue, this important and burning topic. But it is a topic that we know is very contentious. It raises concerns among many of us for a whole variety of different reasons. And because of that, we have a difficult time addressing it directly. So what we wanted to do tonight is create a forum where we could address the intersections of gentrification, urban displacement, race and racism, and the history and present of Halifax in a space that is conducive to debate, conducive to discussion, and hopefully also conducive to challenging power. We at the Radical Imagination Project are an academic research outfit that is explicitly dedicating to empowering, enlivening, and celebrating the capacities of communities to organize against the dominant systems of oppression and exploitation in this society. And it's in that spirit that we welcome you here tonight to take a hard and direct look at the ways that systemic, structural, and other forms of power are operating in our city and in our lives. The Radical Imagination Project was founded in 2010 and has this commitment to catalyzing the possibilities for us to imagine social problems, not in the conventional sense, not in the sense that's given to us by those at City Hall or those who are in power, but from the grassroots, from the bottom up. And we attempt to catalyze the ability for our different communities and our diverse communities to come together and build a place of strength to be able to address these systemic problems. Our next event, which I'll tell you about just briefly, is the book launch for Miles Howe's new book, Debriefing Elsa Bookduk, The Anatomy of a Struggle. That will be a week and a day from tonight on Thursday night, coming up at the Halifax Central Library. Many of you will be familiar with the great struggle at Elsa Bookduk a couple of years ago against hydraulic fracturing, led very courageously by Mi'kmaq land defenders and their Acadian and Anglophone allies as well. Miles is an independent journalist with the Halifax Media Co-op, and he will be launching his new book, which has been published by Fernwood Publishing, stalwart members of the social justice community here in Halifax and indeed across Canada. So that is Thursday evening, May 28th at 6:30 p.m. That is our next event. Many of you have joined us for film screenings at the Halifax Public Library at the New Central Branch and other events in the past, and we look forward to hosting you at future events or working with you to organize events in the future. You can find more information about the Radical Imagination Project at radicalimagination.org. So, tonight's event, we have a half-hour presentation from Ted Rutland, who I'll tell you a little bit more about in a minute. We have three respondents who will speak to the concerns that are raised by his talk and their own work as community activists and as scholars. And we will finally, after that, have time for questions and answers and comments from the audience. We will try and get as many voices as possible, so after our speakers have spoken, I'll ask for comments, and we'll take five or six before turning it back over to the panel to respond. So with that said, I'm going to introduce our speaker and our panelists in a moment, but I would just close this sort of introduction before that by asking you to help us create the atmosphere of healthy debate and discussion and respect, which doesn't mean that we won't challenge prejudices. It doesn't mean that we won't challenge preconceptions. It doesn't mean that the discussion will be easy. It does mean, however, that we are all committed to struggling through these questions together and coming out the other side in the interests of social justice, racial justice, and a better community that works for everyone, not only the interests of those with money and property. So, Ted Rutland is an assistant professor in the Department of Geography, Planning, and Environment at Concordia University in Montreal, and a member of the anti-police brutality collective Groupe d'Action et de Défense contre les Abus Policiers, GADAP, and I apologize for my atrocious French pronunciation. His research focuses on the radical politics of urban planning, housing, and policing in Canadian cities. And following Ted, we have three panelists I'm very, very privileged to be able to introduce you to tonight. Dr. Ingrid Waldron is an assistant professor in the School of Nursing at Dalhousie University. She holds a PhD from the Sociology and Equity Studies and Education Department at the University of Toronto, a master's degree in intercultural education, race, ethnicity, and culture from the Institute of Education at the University of London in England, and a bachelor's degree in psychology from McGill University in Montreal. She's also completed a postdoctoral fellowship in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Dr. Waldron's scholarship focuses on the sociology of race and ethnicity, racism in psychiatry, the social determinants of health, and environmental racism. She recently completed a multi-stage research project on the impacts of gentrification and other social determinants of health and well-being in the African Nova Scotian community in the north end of Halifax. Following her, we have Elle Jones, a spoken word activist and a teacher. She's the two-time captain of the back-to-back national championship Halifax Slam team in 2007 and 2008. Elle has performed all over Canada, including at the 10th anniversary All-Star edition of When Sisters Speak in Toronto. Her poetry is particularly committed to political causes and social justice, and has worked extensively with organizations around Halifax, performing and presenting on issues of social change. She is dedicated to using poetry in prison outreach and youth engagement, and volunteers twice a week at Centerline Studio on the corner of Uniac and Gottigen. Elle is current artistic director of the Word is Bond Spoken Word Artists Collective and teaches at Dalhousie and Acadia Universities, and is indeed Halifax's Poet Laureate, a fact of which we're all extremely proud and grateful. Lynn Jones grew up in Truro, Nova Scotia, where from a young age she struggled against explicit racial segregation. As a university student, she was active against the Vietnam War. She worked in solidarity with struggles for self-determination elsewhere in the world and fought for programs that gave Black and Indigenous students access to post-secondary education. Later, she became active in her union, the Public Service Alliance of Canada, and went on to become the first woman of color to be vice president of the Canadian Labour Congress. Please join me in welcoming them all here and welcoming Ted up to give his presentation.
Thanks very much for all of you for coming out tonight. I don't think I've ever seen a larger crowd gathered in one place to talk about gentrification, and so that's really promising for what is possible tonight and I think in the future. I want to thank as well Max and the Radical Imagination Project for organizing this event, and especially to Elle, Ingrid, and Lynn for participating. I've learned a ton from your writing and activism over the years, and I think a large part of the goal of my own historical research is to try to support the work that you're already doing in a more active way in Halifax today. So my aim tonight is to speak both historically and politically. My aim is to chart a certain path through history that enables us to think about politics in the present, and particularly the politics of gentrification in the present. Sorry, no problem. Now, I don't think that history can tell us what to do concretely, but I think that it can help us to see what people have done in the past, to reflect on what people have done, and therefore to contribute something to the way that we think about what we might do in the present. My hope then is to say a few things about displacement, and something that looks a lot like gentrification in the past, and then pass it over to the discussants and to all of you to think about how what I've said can contribute to a discussion about what might be, how we might understand gentrification in the present, and how one might struggle against gentrification in the present. And so the politics of gentrification, of course, are all around us this evening, and we are sort of in some ways in the center of it. This event is taking place in the north end of Halifax amid an accelerating and increasingly ugly process of north end redevelopment, repopulation, and reimagination. We can see this process in social statistics, and so the price of a home in the North End, and I'm talking just between North and Cornwallis, that's the red line, came to exceed the average price of a home in the HRM sometime in the early 2000s, and that's an historical first. We can see this in new condominium developments, new cafes, new bars, especially along Agricola and Gottingen. And we can see this in a very tangible, everyday kind of way, in planning processes, in discussions of what this neighborhood is, what it could be, and what it means to be a community at this time. And all of this, I imagine, is very tangible and everyday for a lot of you. And so how many of you live in the North End? It's like two-thirds. How many of you feel like the neighborhood is gentrifying? That's almost everybody. How many people feel like they're involved in some way in fighting against gentrification? Some. How many feel like they might be implicated in gentrification? Yeah, also. We can do something about that. It's okay. So gentrification, as many of you know, typically refers to a class process in which a poor or working class population in an area is gradually replaced with a more privileged and or more wealthy population. And this process is usually said to have begun sometime in the 1960s, when this very long process of middle-class suburbanization started to get rerouted. And so sometime in the 1960s, middle-class people continued to live in the suburbs, but some decided that they wanted to live in the inner city as well. And a lot of that meant middle-class people moving into neighborhoods that were either historically working class or neighborhoods that had become working class as a result of middle-class people moving out to the suburbs. And the effects of this are things like displacement, either direct or indirect, like people physically getting removed from their apartments or homes. Also people feeling like the neighborhood is no longer theirs and seeking other places to go. People facing a changing retail environment that maybe doesn't serve them anymore. People facing different kind of policing practices that may target different kinds of behavior that used to be tolerated in the neighborhood before. So there's a whole series of effects that are produced by this process of gentrification, and of course, it's only accelerated since the 1960s. Less important, though, than I think than these particular definitions is how this is lived and experienced by people who live in the neighborhood. And so it's less important to have a kind of technical definition of gentrification than to look and see about what people are concerned about in neighborhoods that we might say are undergoing gentrification. And here I think Ingrid's research is really essential here. And so if you haven't read the report, North End Matters, please do. It's really an exceptional report. And what you see in this report, she's going to talk about a lot, some of it later, but one of the things that I take from it is you see people from the North End, particularly Black and African Nova Scotian residents, talking about what the changes in the neighborhood mean for them. And one of the things people feel is that other people are claiming a neighborhood that used to belong to them, and that the neighborhood is changing in ways that has no connection to what they'd like to see in the neighborhood. They also feel vulnerable to some kind of displacement. They often express that in terms of being able to afford to stay. And I think if we talk about these two things, the claiming process and a displacement process, then we can see that what we call gentrification and what we say began in the 1960s is actually part of a longer continuum, a longer historical continuum in which there's been all kinds of reclaiming and displacement. And I think if we look at that, we might see we might be able to pull out some lessons that are relevant to today. And of course, in Halifax, there hasn't been a moment in its history when there hasn't been a claiming and a displacement process, at least since this area has been gone under the name Halifax. And so Edward Cornwallis is famous, or ought to be famous, for two documents. He's the famous founder of the city, arrives in 1749, on the one hand, a plan for the new city that he's going to found, and the second is a bounty for the scalps of Mi'kmaq people on whose territory this is. And that in that conflict over this effort to found this city, to make this plan a reality, and the people whose land this is, and were never consulted about this, resulted in a conflict, and a bloody one, and a lot of death. And so when we're talking about displacement, claiming, and violence, that's the history of Halifax. And so we ought to think about that, I think, when we're thinking about gentrification in the present, as sort of a continuation of that, with differences, of course. And so what I want to try to do tonight is talk about three moments where there's been a process of displacement and a struggle against it. And I particularly want to look at what I'm calling white ignorance, which is a way that I want to talk about the way that some very well-meaning liberal or progressive white people have sought to contest displacement, but didn't quite do what we might want white have wanted them to do. And so I'll explain what that means as we go. And so the first moment is over 100 years ago, late 1800s. And in this period in Halifax, there was an increasing concern about poor neighborhoods. And the major concern, beginning in the middle of the 1800s, was about the kinds of disease, a contagious disease, that took root in these neighborhoods. And there was a sense, first of all, that poor people are getting ill by things like diphtheria, cholera, etc., that these kinds of disease are contagious, and so we ought to care about whether these people are getting sick, whether we actually care about the people or not, and that these disease outbreaks have some relationship to the places in which people live, like the physical environments in which they live. And so with these concerns, there begins to be a whole series of plans to demolish people's homes, to eliminate the source of disease by eliminating people's presence in the city. What's important, though, and so this is a map of, which you can barely see, but a map of diphtheria in 1890. And there's some red dots that you can faintly see, and they're concentrated in what we know now, what we call now the North End, as well as some parts of the older part of the South End near the docks, which were both very poor neighborhoods. What's important, I think, to pull out from this is that soon after all these people are talking about demolishing these neighborhoods for pretty self-interested kind of reasons, a progressive movement emerges. And this is actually the period where the term progressive gets used. And it refers to people who actually want to achieve some kind of social change, a positive social change that isn't revolutionary, but that has concerns about poverty, about how people are living, about working conditions, about what people are getting paid, about whether government is democratic, all these kinds of things. And what we find is that the progressives entered the fray, entered the politics of displacement that were emerging, but rather than stopping the displacement, they substituted a different kind of argument for it. And so what we find then is a lot of very well-meaning white progressives saying that, yes, we ought to like bulldoze people's homes. They didn't have bulldozers yet, just squash their homes. And we ought to like displace them, not because we're only concerned that we might get sick, but because these people are living in bad housing conditions. And because we care about them, we ought to put them in better housing conditions. And that second part didn't always work out into the plans. And so this concern with people's housing conditions leads to a whole series of new organizations, a whole series of campaigns around quote-unquote slum housing. It led to, for example, a five-part expose of the slums in the Halifax Herald in 1906 that really brought the reading public's attention to how people were living. And so I want to talk briefly about a couple, what came to light in that five-part expose. And so the area that they focused on was an area that used to be called the Upper Streets. Has anyone heard of the Upper Streets? It's the area where Scotia Square is now, which was... So you know where this is going, basically. Birmingham, Jacob, all these kinds of streets, which was one of the sort of high-profile, low-income slums, right, in the early 1900s. And the composition of the neighborhood is almost entirely poor, of mixed ethnicities. Some people are African Nova Scotian, a lot of people are Irish, some people are from Cape Breton, some people are Acadian. But predominantly some kind of version of white. But the expose was particularly interested in the homes of black families who were called colored in this context. And so I'll read a brief passage from one of the articles in the Halifax Herald. The scene in the small room was not to be easily effaced from the mind. The place had the foul smell appertaining to rooms in which human beings have literally, quote-unquote, lived for weeks, and from which, during that time, all fresh air has been excluded. As you entered the door, you saw to the left, ranged into confusion and dirt, cooking utensils and two empty kettles on a little stove in which there was no fire. Everything appeared to have a composite varnish of dirt and grease, and on a miserable table, an oil lamp gave a feeble light. To the right were what appeared to be two beds, moved so close together as to be practically one, which is morally, should not do that. In them lay three small children, including a baby, and just beyond them, so still as hardly appearing to breathe, and swathed in dirty woolen rags, lay a colored woman. She turned when conscious that a stranger had entered, and it developed then that there was another baby, 9 days old, living in the curve of a brown arm. And so this invasion of people's private lives was, of course, well-intentioned in a certain vague sense. They were meant to bring attention to the conditions that people were living in and to mobilize some kind of public concern about this, some kind of public support for some change. These efforts eventually resulted in a 1905 plan to demolish what was then called the upper streets and build a set of model tenements in their place. And so this is what the model tenements were supposed to look like. They were based on a similar undertaking that had happened in Liverpool, England, in the 1880s. The plan would bulldoze 8 blocks of the downtown, this area called the upper streets, and build 550 well-designed housing units in their place, and so house around 1,500 people. It's unclear how many people from the neighborhood would have actually ended up in these new units, but the history of model tenements construction shows that probably something like half the people displaced ended up rehoused in these projects. The plan was never carried through for lack of money, but what was implemented was a whole series of smaller initiatives that aimed to eliminate bad housing conditions and uplift and moralize the city's poor. And so parks were created where poor and working class children could play under the supervision of middle class men and women, mostly women. A children's aid society was formed, which could take away the children of parents who seemed to be behaving badly. Parents could also be charged or imprisoned because of the bad behavior of their children in public. And the Board of Health finally ordered the destruction of a whole series of homes which were deemed to be in bad condition. So there's the Board of Health inspector improving housing conditions. And all of these efforts were resisted in various kinds of ways. And so working class and poor mothers refused to send their children to these supervised playgrounds, even though this is basically free childcare. And so we ought to, they understand something about what's going on there that perhaps the people who are organizing the childcare don't. An interesting thing happened where an exhibit was set up on Gottesgen Street to kind of instruct the poor and working class families, like how to keep their home nice, how to like maintain their lawns, how to basically be good middle class people without middle class incomes, and a group of black youth would hang out by the display and like throw pieces of cardboard at people when they walked by and looked at it, and they eventually like demolished the display. Particularly compelling to me is the mother of a family that appeared before the Board of Health in 1906. So the family was the Orton family. I don't know anything about them beyond these few records that I've come across. And it was Mrs. Orton, the mother of the family, who appeared before the Board of Health in 1906. And it was at this meeting that the future of her home, whether it was going to be allowed to exist or whether it was going to be demolished because it was like bad living conditions, was going to be decided. And so the board tells her, your living conditions are filthy, this is horrible. She says, I'm keeping them as clean as I can, and I can't get nicer living conditions in this city with the money that I make. This report on this Board of Health meeting also reveals that Mrs. Orton was basically taking care of her children by herself because her husband had put in jail because of the bad behavior of their children. The report also reveals that the windows of their home had been removed by the city due to a previous board decision about the bad condition of the home, which was meant to get them out of there, and so they have no windows in February in Halifax. And so we have it. This woman is making do without her husband, with no windows in January, all because some people want to improve her living conditions. And so, there are some very sinister people involved in these plots, but I think it's important to think about these people who think they're doing something useful, but have no idea what it would mean to do something useful. And so I think that their involvement in this struggle over displacement is really important. And so there was a pre-existing move to displace people based on quite self-interested, kind of nefarious kinds of desires, and then white progressives emerge and give a more palatable kind of argument for displacement. So they don't stop displacement, they provide a different argument for it, none of which considers what people who are in these living conditions and in these neighborhoods would actually want. And I think there we can note a particular kind of ignorance that comes from these people's social position as both middle class and white in a society structured by class and race. And I'll come back to that notion of ignorance, what I want to mean by that in a moment. The second moment that I want to talk about is the 1960s. And so everyone know what happened in the 1960s? Africville gets displaced in the 1960s. And so There's people here who know this history, obviously, tremendously better than I do. But if you don't know this history at all, it's really important that you do understand it. And there's an NFP documentary called Remember Africville that is free on the website. And if you're living in Halifax and don't know this history, I really urge you to take the 30 minutes to watch this documentary and then go further than that. But for those who don't know it, the basic history is that Africville was a community of 400 African Nova Scotian people at the northern edge of the Halifax Peninsula. It was founded in the mid-1800s, although some people had probably lived there prior to that. And then this city, central city, developed northward. There was a sort of taking of Africville land and eventually a series of plans to demolish the neighborhood entirely, expropriate the land, displace the residents. Some of those residents ended up in Mulgrave Park and Uniacke Square. Some of them didn't. And so Africville is clearly an essential story. And learning about this in my early 20s sort of eliminated a tiny bit of the naivety that I had about Canada and my place within it as a white person. But I've always got the sense from African Nova Scotian people that I've met in Halifax that Africville was important because of the people who were affected and because of the place. But it was also important because of that it symbolized something bigger, something broader, and sort of a broader history of mistreatment, institutional racism, and displacement. And so a lot of my research is trying to come to grips with that something broader. And so I won't speak too much about Africville, but actually try to think about what else was happening in that time. And so part of this broader thing, it seems to me, becomes clear when we notice that Africville was one amongst a whole series of communities that were targeted for displacement and that were displaced in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. The first community to go was this area that used to be called the Upper Streets and where Scotia Square is now. And so between 1958 and 1961, between 1,600 and 2,000 people, mostly poor, mostly white, but some African Nova Scotian people are pushed out of this neighborhood. A lot of them are supposed to get public housing units, but the public housing doesn't get opened until 3 years after a lot of them were displaced, and so people just get scattered. A lot of people were never offered public housing units to begin with. So there's somewhere between 1,600 and 2,000 people. In 1959, the city expanded this project both south and north, and so eliminated an area around Maitland, an area in the sort of older part of the south end, and displaced another 300 people. Another neighborhood that suffered displacement is the neighborhood just east of here, between north and Cornwallis, east of Gottingen. And so this area, and which includes where Uniacke Square was now, which used to be housing, which is still housing, but it used to be another form of housing. And so in 1961, there was a plan hatched to demolish all of this area and build a massive sort of commercial, retail, middle-class housing and public housing complex along the whole area. It would have displaced 3,500 people if the plan had gone to fruition. It didn't. So probably only somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 2,500 people were displaced between 1961 and 1980. In addition to these two plans, the city maintained a program of targeted demolitions beginning in 1958, and so targeting houses anywhere in the city that fell below the housing code, and that resulted in around 600 people being displaced. And so in total, we're talking about 5,000 people displaced in Halifax in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, in addition to the people displaced from Africville. Some of these people get new public housing, many of them don't, many are scattered. Of this sort of population, how many are African Nova Scotian? We have no precise figures, but the city is specifically targeting neighborhoods where African Nova Scotians are predominant. They're not the majority in a lot of these neighborhoods, but this is the sort of Halifax home of the African Nova Scotian communities. Africville, North End, et cetera. And so we're talking at least 600 African Nova Scotia people displaced, probably double that, maybe even triple. And so all of this is for sure classist in the sense that these people are poor, working class people who are getting displaced. But I think there are a whole bunch of ways in which it's racist too. And there are some people who say that, you know, it's because what's common amongst all of this is that people are like poor and don't have a lot of political power. We should really say that it's that and it's not racist, but I think we have to insist on and think about why this is also racist. And one of many ways in which we can highlight the racism of these actions is to look at these white liberals or white progressives who once again come into the debate about displacement and give it a different flavor. And so next to there's all these people who want the land, who want to make profit, who want to create a particular image of the city that doesn't include poor people living in the kinds of housing that they're living in. There's also a desire to like control people to keep them under supervision in public housing. All kinds of like sinister and horrible kinds of intentions. Alongside those people, there's a few people who think that they can do something good through this plan. And their argument becomes very familiar. It's the same one as in the early 1900s, which is that people are living in deplorable housing conditions. We need to offer something better. And we're going to do that even though they don't want to move necessarily, right? And so what this thinking ignored is that black people in Upperville and in the North End were largely homeowners. And that homeownership provided ways of surviving in a racist society. So less important to like navigate a racist rental housing market because you own your home. Less important to navigate a racist labor market because you don't have to pay rents. You don't need as much money. And there's all kinds of forms of subsistence, like gardening, keeping animals, etc., that allow you to survive in a racist society. And so what I want to say is that this elimination of poor people's homes and putting them in public housing might have created some benefit for white, poor, and working class people, although many of them contested this. So even that is a little bit too charitable. But when we're talking about poor and working class black people in Halifax, this process is quasi-genocidal. It's like removing their ability to sustain themselves physically, emotionally, and community, and placing them in a situation where they have to pay rent, where they won't be able to have access to like gardening, raising animals, etc. And so like eliminates their ability to like survive in the system. And so one of the reasons that these 1950s, 1960s, 1970s processes of displacement are racist, even though they don't only affect African Nova Scotian people, is that you've got a few of these kind of progressive and liberal white people who are trying to help. But the only way that they can try to imagine helping is actually imagining helping white people. They're imagining like poor working class renters getting better rental housing. They actually aren't caring or listening or paying attention to what actually is going on in black communities and what, if anything, might be desired in terms of urban planning. So they could have listened. And so we've got a whole bunch of people who are in addition to the nefarious evil people, who are trying to be helpful but have no clue what it means to help, even though they're facing like people telling them that they don't want to move, right? And so here's where I want to introduce this idea of white ignorance. And I would say that between a set of perspectives, say the perspectives of Africville residents who are saying that we don't want your plan, and these a collection of liberal and progressive white people who think that they know what's best, is a kind of ignorance. And so this term comes from the work of an African-American philosopher named Charles Mills, where he's describing a kind of ignorance that's not biological. He's not saying white people are biologically stupid, but a kind of socially produced ignorance. And so it's an ignorance that emerges from a social structure in which there's a whole set of walls, obstacles, and violences that people of color face that white people don't face. And so because they don't face it, they don't necessarily understand it, and they don't integrate it into their understanding of the way the world works. So basically, white people, it sounds paradoxical, but don't necessarily understand racism, even though they're the ones perpetuating it. And they don't necessarily take account for the effects that racism has on people's lives when they're thinking about how the world works, how the society works, and how their experience of the world, while we're constantly told that like our experience is like everyone's experience, that everyone experiences the world the same way, and that our experience is just like the truth, we don't recognize the ways in which that's actually a very particular experience. To walk through the world without experiencing racism is like particular. Some people go through the world like that, not everyone. And so what that means is, white people in a social structure organized around racism and white supremacy have this kind of huge blind spot, huge kind of ignorance in their perspective on the world. And so it's actually a very particular way of understanding the world, even though we're told that we understand everything. And it's a very particular kind of experience in the world, even though we're constantly told that our experience is just the experience, like the neighborhood is just the neighborhood, poverty is just poverty, etc. And we can always say, of course, we can always retort and say, well, everyone's experience is particular, and everyone's kind of like segregated into their own little perspective on the world. And maybe there's some truth to that, But what Mills says, and what people like James Baldwin have said, and what lots of people that I know have said, is that to be a person of color in a racist society means you kind of have to understand white people. You have to understand, like, their ideas, because they're everywhere in the public space. They're in advertisements, they're in discussions, they're in the newspaper. And you have to understand how they behave, because they're going to create obstacles for you. And so while it's very possible for white people to go through the world without ever really understanding the lives of people of color, it's actually very seldom the case that people of color don't understand anything about white people. And so it's a kind of ignorance that's socially produced. It's a kind of ignorance that is a kind of racism. It's part of racism. It's part of what maintains this society. And one of its products is creating these people who think that their experience is everyone's experience, think they know what to do, but actually don't really know a lot. This can be reduced, this ignorance, but it's there, and we got to recognize it. And that, so this, I think, we can see in the progressives in the early 1900s. I think we can see it in some of the progressives in the 1960s, and I want to say that we can see it in the last example that I want to point to as well. And so the very last example, which I have to go through very briefly, emerged in the late 1960s, and so not amid all the struggle over urban renewal. And it was actually the first struggle on a large scale to kind of stop a plan that would have displaced a large number of people. And so the plan in question was the plan to create this highway along the east part of the peninsula. It's in dotted lines along the bottom called Harbor Drive North. And this plan would have had all kinds of negative effects. It would have displaced 80 to 100 families in the old North End. It would have demolished a bunch of heritage buildings in the downtown. It would have destroyed a children's playground near UNIX Square. And there are a whole bunch of reasons in which people contested it. It was contested, and ultimately successfully, by a coalition of groups, which was a coalition that eventually included about 40 local activist groups, included groups like Heritage Trust, Ecology Action Center, etc. And they mounted a campaign in the fall of 1971 to contest this plan. In 1972, they were successful. The city abandoned the plan and obviously hasn't built that plan since. And I think it's a good thing that they won for obvious reasons. But there's something that I want to worry about in the way that they frame their opposition. And it's less about opposing it due to the displacement of these families, which is super important, the wrecking of this playground, but the particular kind of vision of urban space that they put forward in their opposition to this plan. And so one of the arguments that they made was that this expressway would destroy the kind of experience that existed in the downtown and that could exist to an even greater extent in the future. And that was experience that was described as the existence of this like lively, vibrant downtown, or a place to live, work, and enjoy ourselves on a 24-hour basis. And the reason I want to worry a little bit about that, and it's not a huge criticism of the activists, it's actually just a kind of worrying that I think we can do more in hindsight, is that that kind of idea of a lively, vibrant space or a place to live, work, and enjoy ourselves, this is the first example in Halifax of that vision. Previously to that, for 100 years, there's been a war on public space, a try to keep people out of public space. You can live and enjoy yourself in your private space. Do not be in public. And so this is like a huge moment in which we see a different way of being in public space. And it's exactly that idea that freights gentrification, right? And so the positive arguments for gentrification are a lot about creating a lively, dynamic, hip, authentic kind of place. And so I want to say that kind of idea that's freighting gentrification is emerging in this time. Why worry about that? I worry about that because I'm compelled by that idea. I want to live in a lively, vibrant kind of neighborhood. But I'm worrying about it more because if you look at what's going on in the downtown at that moment where people are describing it as a lively, vibrant place, it's that, first of all, we got rid of the downtown slum. And so 2,000 poor working class, some white, some racialized people are moved out of the downtown. If we look at the downtown at that time, groups like the Black United Front are saying that black people can't get a job downtown, can't rent an apartment downtown, can't get served in businesses downtown, can't basically get served outside of the North End itself. And so what appears to certain activists to be the space of like liveliness and vibrance is actually a space that a lot of people can't be in, that they're not in and that they can't be in. And so whose experience is this? Whose enjoyment is this? And what does it mean to suddenly say we want a downtown that's going to be lively and vibrant after these historical and present processes of pushing people out of it? And so I think in that vision, it's a particular kind of ignorance, which is that people don't people who are espousing this view don't recognize that what they experience as lively and vibrant is not everyone's experience. And that if we actually wanted to create a lively, vibrant neighbor, like downtown for everyone, we'd actually have to do particular things like tackle racial discrimination, think about like access to housing, etc. And that wasn't done. It could have been done, but it wasn't. And so coming into the present, I want to say that we've got these, I want to pull from these examples and say we've got three big examples of displacement, three examples in which there's all kinds of like nefarious, profit-driven, like dominatory kinds of reasons for displacing people. But in every moment, there's kind of progressive voice that comes and says, we want to do displacement differently in some ways. And I think in all of these cases, we can see the ways in which a socially produced form of ignorance makes it possible to believe that these things are good when, in fact, they're actually quite damaging to a lot of people. And so if we're thinking about gentrification in the present, then, there's a series of questions that I think we need to ask. What kinds of ideas are driving gentrification in the present? Whose experiences do these represent? If we say the neighborhood is improving, whose experience is that? For whom is the neighborhood not improving, either because it's getting visibly worse or because they're already gone? If we say that Gottesian Street is getting safer, for whom is it getting safer? If we say more progressively, and here's the harder thing, right? If we say more progressively that we're opposed to gentrification, who's coming up with this vision of anti-gentrification? Who's defining what gentrification means? Who decides what's important? What gets protected? What doesn't? Who decides? And basically what I'm saying is that what we can pull out of history is a sense that that if we don't think concretely about how racism works through these processes of displacement, then what we're liable to have is an anti-gentrification politics that's essentially a white politics, and that results in a whole bunch of racialized people, and I think particularly black people in this neighborhood, get displaced. How to avoid this, obviously, is to figure out where black people are struggling against displacement, who's organizing these kinds of struggles, and to prioritize these struggles, by which I mean not putting them alongside a whole bunch of other kinds of ideas, but actually making these the center, thinking about how to oppose gentrification by supporting black struggles against gentrification where those exist. And I think that to do that now, right, in a period where the black population in Halifax is on the descent, the only way in which an anti-gentrification politics is legitimate in this context, I think, is to prioritize the struggles of black communities against displacement. And so I'm arguing in the end for an anti-gentrification politics that prioritizes the experience, demands, and interests of black North Enders. What would this mean concretely? History can't tell us that, and I don't think that a white professor should be telling you that, ultimately. And so what I would like to do is conclude now, thank you, and pass it over to other people who know better.